This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
I'm Katia Adler from the Global Story podcast. Today we're looking at Sudan and the brutal conflict raging there. We hear from some of the millions of civilians brutalized and displaced. It's been dubbed the Forgotten War. But is it more ignored than forgotten by the international community? And if so, why? Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, I'm James Kimarasamy. Thank you for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast for Monday, the 23rd of September. Lebanese officials say nearly 500 people have been killed in Israeli bombing raids in the south of the country. We'll hear from the Lebanese health minister and from a former US ambassador to Lebanon. He'll tell us what the outside world can or can't do to stop the conflict from escalating any further. After Rachel Reeves sets out an optimistic vision for Britain's future in her first Labour Party conference speech as Chancellor. We'll look ahead to Keir Starmer's speech tomorrow with a government minister and two new MPs. And we hear how events in the Middle East are being reflected on the fringes of the conference. We'll also speak to the sports journalist who was barred from Saturday's big fight at Wembley after he criticised its Saudi organisers. The Labour Party conference in Liverpool. And later on in the programme, we'll be looking ahead to Sir Keir Starmer's speech tomorrow. But we're going to begin with developments overseas and a fast-moving situation in Lebanon. Where the sound of war on the ground and in the air is drowning out the growing international cries for de-escalation. Today, Israeli warplanes took part in the deadliest bombing raids in southern Lebanon in more than two decades. According to the Lebanese authorities, nearly 500 people have died and more than 1,000 have been injured as the new scale of Israel's campaign against Hezbollah is rapidly becoming clearer. For the past week, Israel has pivoted all its fighting energies towards the Iranian-backed militia, which has been firing rockets into northern Israel since the day after the October the 7th attacks, driving tens of thousands of Israelis from their homes. Israel says it struck more than 1,000 Hezbollah targets today. Well, that followed a message to the people of southern Lebanon, 80,000 phone calls warning them to leave Hezbollah strongholds, backed up by a video message from the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu.
I have a message for the people of Lebanon. Israel's war is not with you. It's with Hezbollah. For too long, Hezbollah has been using you as human shields. It placed rockets in your living rooms and missiles in your garage. Those rockets and missiles are aimed directly at our cities, directly at our citizens. To defend our people against Hezbollah strikes, we must take out those weapons.
Zahra Soli is a 20-year-old student who lives with her family just outside the southern Lebanese city of Nabatea. They've been renting a flat there since February after they fled their home village on the border with Israel because of the ongoing exchanges of rocket fire. And Zahra spoke to the BBC earlier about the situation there.
We can hear the planes all night almost. And by the morning, we started to hear the strikes. I woke up at 6 a.m. to the sound of bombing and all of that. By noon, it started to get very intense, and I saw a lot of strikes around my area. I heard a lot of glass shattering, and plus the airplanes. There was the building between my house and another building that collapsed. I didn't see it clearly, but it was indeed a building with civilian inside. And I heard a lot of ambulance coming and fire trucks. I think that staying outside my house will cause the... Okay. I don't know if you heard that, but that was a strike right there. They are coming closer. We don't see it feel safe, obviously, but this is our land. We can't just abandon our land.
A snapshot of life in southern Lebanon. Well, Israel's stated military goal there is to do enough damage to Hezbollah to allow the displaced Israelis to return home. Among the 60,000 Israelis who were evacuated from the north of the country is Daniela Porat-Penso. She's from the small community kibbutz of Yiftach, less than a mile from the Lebanese border. A few months ago, she decided to return. She's one of just a handful of people who've done that. My colleague Tim Franks asked her what it was like in the kibbutz now.
It's very quiet. I mean, nobody's there except for me and some other maybe 10 or so civilians and our defense squad. We hear the bombing in Lebanon. We hear the bombing in Israel. Bomb drones flying over us, so we have alarms. It's very tense.
When you say you hear drones overhead, these are drones that are flying out of southern Lebanon?
Yes. When our defense detects them, sometimes they're being shot in the air above us, and sometimes they just move on and going to somewhere else. I don't know if we're the target.
And when the sirens go off saying that you may be under attack, how long have you got to get to a safe place?
Nothing. No time. Sometimes, you know, I'm in my kitchen and I hear the siren, and on my way to the safe room, I hear like an interception or something. So there's no real time. I'm sad to say that I'm used to it.
Given that you're just a kilometer or two from the border, why have you decided to go back to your kibbutz?
I saw no good reason why not to. I mean, I was tired of being away from home. I was away from home 7 or 8 months, and I really missed my home. I felt that I'm not afraid, and I don't have small children. I just have my dogs, and I have a car, so I can, you know, drive away whenever I need to. It's just a choice. It's a choice between two bad things. That's what I decided.
I don't know how far you're willing to talk about this, but I have spoken to other people who either still do live in the north of Israel or did live in the north of Israel and have been evacuated elsewhere. A decent number of them say they don't particularly want war with Hezbollah, but they do say we have to do something about the fact that so many people have been forced to flee their homes. And so if there is a big operation against Hezbollah, so be it. Can I ask what your thoughts are?
Basically, I don't believe in war. I don't believe that war stops war. I cannot tell you whether it's a good thing or it will be a good result if we have a war with Hezbollah or not. I have no idea. I just have my view on life. And I'm a peace seeker, so I have to keep my hope up.
That was Daniela Porat-Penso speaking to my colleague Tim Franks from her kibbutz in northern Israel. Well, Firaz Abiad is the Lebanese health minister. A short while ago, he told me about the impact of today's airstrikes on his country's emergency services.
Two of our healthcare workers were killed and 16 were injured. Also, there were attacks on firefighting engines, on ambulances, and one healthcare center.
And what about people fleeing their homes? What do you know about that?
There are probably, I would estimate, tens of thousands. On my way to the ministry, I passed one of the large evacuation centers, and it looked full.
So people are fleeing from the south, coming to Beirut, are they, in large numbers?
Yeah. I think that this is probably one of the aims of what happened, this indiscriminate attack on civilians. In my opinion, the main aim was to instigate this exodus of a large number of civilians from the targeted areas.
The Israelis did send messages, didn't they? They said that they were not targeting civilians. They were targeting Hezbollah very specifically and warning people about these in advance. Did that have an impact?
No, I don't think so. I think because if you look at the areas that were targeted, the vast majority, if not all of them, were civilian areas. And even, you know, if you look at the timing between those messages that were sent and the time the attack started, you could see that this was not serious at all. I mean, the aim was just, in my opinion, is a show.
And Israel, as you will know, is very explicit that it is turning its focus, and it's been saying that for the past week, to the Israel-Lebanon border, to that area. And it says it is doing that in response to the 9,000 Hezbollah rocket attacks, which it says have killed dozens of Israelis. and Hezbollah has kept up the attacks, hasn't it? It hasn't stopped. Is this going to have any impact on Hezbollah?
I think that especially if you look at the sequence of events of the last week, it's clear that I think the Israeli government's intention is to escalate, it's to provoke. And personally, I think that the decision to escalate has already been taken. And all of these statements are performed, as they say.
Are you now in an all-out war with Israel?
I mean, we have been in de facto war with Israel ever since last October, but I think that we have gone into a new stage of war where initially it was sort of really targeted attacks, but now it's indiscriminate. I think for the past week, we have seen an indiscriminate attacks where most of the casualties
These are targeted at Hezbollah strongholds, though, aren't they?
No, these are not targeted Hezbollah strongholds. Anyone who wants to go up to the south, they will tell you that these are not military posts or Hezbollah posts. These were residential areas. These were areas filled with civilians.
And what about the state of Lebanon? You've had all kinds of problems, but you are now, as you say, effectively at war with Israel, although it is not the Lebanese army, is it? It is Hezbollah, which is a non-state actor in all of this. What is this doing to your country?
The vast majority of the population do not want war. But at the same time, I don't think that the escalation is something that is because of what Lebanon is doing. You know, the decision has been made across the border that escalation is required for whatever reason. We have to adjust to that as much as we can.
What can you do, though? Obviously, your prime minister has postponed his visit to the United Nations. Do you get a sense that outside powers are trying to bring an end to this?
Our prime minister has been in conversation. Our minister of foreign affairs is already in New York. There is ongoing a lot of discussions. We have a French envoy already present in Beirut. And I think that there is a lot of effort that are being done to see how can we reach a de-escalation of the situation. I know that the U.S. has also called for all parties to refrain from going into escalatory actions. We believe that the good starting point to try to de-escalate is to reach some kind of a ceasefire from Gaza to Lebanon. And I think that will also remove any pretext for any non-state actors such as Hezbollah or others to try to instigate or send rockets across the border and so on.
That was Firaz Abiad, the Lebanese health minister, speaking to me a little while ago. Well, the UN Secretary General has expressed alarm at what is happening. The United States says it is working on de-escalation, but it is also sending more troops to the region and urging its citizens to leave Lebanon while commercial options exist. That message has already come from the British government. So what can outside powers and Israel's main ally, America in particular, bring to the table to help to end the bloodshed, to de-escalate the situation? David Hale is a former U.S. ambassador to Lebanon, former U.S. special envoy for Middle East peace during the Obama administration. He's currently a distinguished diplomatic fellow at the Wilson Center in Washington, D.C., and joins us now. Welcome to the program, Ambassador.
Thank you very much.
What do you make of today's events, first of all?
Well, as you've just said in the last segment, we have seen the Israelis signal very clearly through both words and actions that their attention has now shifted from a focus on Gaza to a focus on the northern border with Lebanon. I think that my interpretation of that is that they feel increasingly confident that they have gained the upper hand in their military operations in Gaza, whether or not there's a ceasefire, that they now have the ability to address the problem of Hezbollah. And the mindset in Israel is, of course, after October 7, never again. So unless the United States or other actors can come up with a really credible roadmap in which diplomacy can deliver security and stability, the Israelis will be pursuing these kinds of military options, successfully or not.
What are the chances of that? As I said, America is actually sending more troops to the region. It's clearly worried that this is going to get even more serious. Talk is of de-escalation, but is there any evidence that that is something that America is able to bring about?
Well, the United States has been, of course, historically a critical partner in bringing about de-escalations and ceasefires when there are these episodes between Hezbollah and Israel, or the PLO before Hezbollah. But my own observation, and it's just an opinion, but my observation from the sidelines is that the United States has been largely irrelevant in terms of its political and diplomatic influence over the course of this war. And I have seen, of course, they've sent an envoy a number of times to offer ideas, but I haven't seen anything that really is convincing to the Israelis that there is a strategic shift that can come about through diplomacy, and that's a real problem.
And is that irrelevant because of actions America has or hasn't taken, or what?
Well, I just don't think that either our Israeli friends or our Iranian and opponents and their proxies, whether Hamas or Hezbollah, have been frankly impressed by what the United States has had to offer. The ideas have been episodic and haven't stuck. So whether it's a lack of power or a lack of influence or a lack of credibility of the ideas themselves, and perhaps a combination of all of that, we now have the added factor, of course, that the Biden administration is entering into its twilight years. We call it here in our country the lame duck period. So regardless of the outcome in November, this team will be gone in January, and that will also further diminish their ability to influence events.
One area where both our languages coincide, not always the case, but yes, the lame duck president, just a few weeks really left in office. You think there is nothing that can be done? I mean, is there?
No.
Does Antony Blinken have a role to play in trying to bring about peace?
Of course, they must do everything they can, and we do have a role to play. The problem is that the address is not really in southern Lebanon and Hezbollah, certainly not the Lebanese government, which I have many friends and colleagues there, but the government doesn't have any real say-so over over Hezbollah. It's Iran. And it's very difficult to construct a strategy in a matter of weeks as an administration is leaving office that can really compel the Iranians to think that there are costs to their current course of action and that of their proxies. So it would be very difficult to build something that could be meaningful, but they should definitely keep trying. And there's too much at stake. And obviously we see this humanitarian tragedy unfolding like we have so many times before.
David, many, many thanks. Ambassador David Hale, former U.S. ambassador to Lebanon, former U.S. special envoy for Middle East peace during the Obama administration. And you can keep across developments in the Middle East throughout the day with the live news stream on BBC Sounds. Just go to the live dial at the top of the BBC Sounds homepage and tap on live news. Now, coming up later, the big fight at Wembley on Saturday night ended like this. Well, as you can hear, a big crowd, 96,000 people were there. But I'll be speaking to a journalist who was denied entry after he criticised Saudi Arabia's financial backing of that.
I'm Katia Adler from the Global Story podcast. Today, we're looking at Sudan and the brutal conflict raging there. We hear from some of the millions of civilians brutalised and displaced. It's been dubbed the Forgotten War. But is it more ignored than forgotten by the international community? And if so, why? Find us wherever you get your podcast.
Fight. But now let's turn to the Labour Party conference. The purpose behind the pain. That's what we're expecting Keir Starmer to outline here in Liverpool tomorrow when the Prime Minister gives his speech at conference. Change begins. That's a two-word slogan for this week. And the leader's speech presents him with an opportunity to change perceptions of his government, to set out what kind of country he is hoping to build. He'll be building on his Chancellor, Rachel Reeves' attempt today to change the mood music with her speech. No backing down from her on some of the unpopular decisions she says she's had to make, such as cutting winter fuel payments for many pensioners. But on a damp day in Liverpool, she was leaning into the idea of a sunnier future on the horizon.
My optimism for Britain burns brighter than ever. My ambition knows no limits. Growth is the challenge and investment is the solution.
We'll hear from a government minister in just a moment, but I've been speaking to two of the new intake of Labour MPs. Dan Tomlinson represents Chipping Barnet, a traditionally Conservative constituency in North London, and Josh Simons is MP for Makerfield, an old Labour constituency in the North West region, not far from Liverpool. Starting with Dan, how can Labour reset the dial after a couple of weeks of pretty doom-laden messaging?
It's not going to be easy, and the public get that. So I've been out knocking on doors in my constituency every week since the election, more or less. And the public, people who even voted Tory last time, are saying to me, we're not judging this government yet. You're a new government. You've only just taken office. They know the mess that we've inherited, and they're giving us time. I think the budget that's coming up will be a really big moment, and I think Keir's speech tomorrow will be a really big moment for us too as well.
Well, let's move and look ahead to tomorrow. Josh, what do you want to hear from your leader? Because the opinion polls suggest that there is already a certain nervousness or a certain scepticism, even amongst people that voted for you just a few months ago.
So the fundamental problem that this government faces is that trust in politics is at a record low. The process of rebuilding that trust is fundamentally about delivery and about communicating that delivery over the next 4 or 5 years. And the time that it'll take the government to do that is different to the sort of addiction that we now have to, you know, insider Westminster dramas. Keir's speech will be forward-looking. It'll be about the agenda, and that is what we need to be talking about.
You're nodding along, Dan.
Well, yeah, the public, I'm sure, will want their Prime Minister, their newly elected Prime Minister, who was given a mandate just a few short weeks ago, 172-seat majority, to talk about what he and this government are going to do to fulfil that mandate, to make sure that the pledges that were in the manifesto that Josh and I were elected on are acted upon.
Change begins is the slogan. And you, as someone who is in a traditional Tory seat, elected as a Labour MP, I guess you sort of embody the hopes. So how do you live up to them?
Well, it's a mixture of the government delivering on its promises. So today we heard from the Chancellor about bringing forward hundreds of new breakfast clubs before schools. It's about hiring, for example, the 1,300 new police officers that we need. It's about making sure that we can deliver nationally and locally as well. And I think people will see in the years and months to come the change that having a Labour MP and a Labour government can make.
And we heard there from new Labour MPs Dan Tomlinson and Josh Simons. Well, with me here is Sarah Jones, Minister of State for Business and Trade, Energy and Net Zero. She's the MP for Croydon West. Welcome to the programme.
Evening.
Good to have you. So Sir Keir Starmer is going to be speaking tomorrow. Change begins. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the changes that's happened since the election is he's now less popular than Rishi Sunak after winning a landslide against him. I mean, how is it possible and what does he need to do to turn things around?
Well, look, people are rightly sceptical about politics at the moment. And Josh and Dan just talked about that. And they're right. On the doorstep, people are sceptical about the ability of politicians to deliver. And it'll
sceptical
take time.
About the government.
It'll take time to turn that around. And the message, I think, from Keir tomorrow will be that the change has begun. And that if we make the tough decisions that are needed, that Rachel talked about today, that the prize will be immense, that we can fix the foundations, that we can build a country that everybody wants to see. Now, we have done more in 11 weeks than the last government did in years. Whether you look at the planning reform, lifting the ban on onshore wind, border security command, the National Wealth Fund, setting up Great British Energy with Jürgen Meyer as its chair, there is a huge amount of activity in the last few weeks. We need now to set a budget that will set the foundations for the change we want to see. Now, I'm the industry minister. I spend all my time talking to business. They want to invest in this country. They want to grow their businesses. They want to do the right things. The barriers are there that have been there for years. We will break them down.
So the short-term pain isn't going to go away, though, and Rachel Reeves is not saying it is. I mean, how do you stop that obscuring this message that you want to give of longer term, a longer term prize that I think she's talking about?
Well, she will set out in the budget the changes that she wants to see. She was very clear that there will be no return to austerity. And we have seen and we are seeing cash injections, whether
it's
through...
what is it? Because she said it's not austerity, but what is it? Because it is still a tightening of the belt.
We have to be responsible and we have to respond to the situation that we found ourselves in. And she will set out in the budget how she's going to do that. But we have vehicles that will secure growth in this country. The National Wealth Fund will crowd in private sector investment. We are all working really hard with businesses to understand what those barriers are. The National Wealth Fund will be a vehicle for growth. Great British Energy will be a vehicle for growth and jobs. The cash injection that we're putting through things like changes to non-dom status, tax avoidance measures, VAT on private schools, all of these things will put the injection of cash now into our public sector. But we know that in the long term we need to grow the economy.
I was going to say, but a lot of these that measures you're talking about are not short term measures. It's going to take a long time for them to bed in and them to show benefits in the short term. How are you going to keep people on board? Don't you need to tell a better story? Doesn't the Prime Minister need to tell a better story in the short term?
Well, I'm not sure it's about telling a story. It's about being honest and being ambitious. And we are honest with the public about the challenges that we've inherited. I'm in the Department of Business and Trade and Energy and Net Zero. There are huge horrors that we encountered when we first arrived into office. Nobody wants us to not be honest about that. But we have massive ambition at the same time. Everywhere I go around the country, there are people with huge talent and that talent is being held back. And it has to be the job of a sensible Labour government in the interest of working people to say this is a long-term plan. We will have cash injections now where we need them. That is happening. But we will make sure we have a long-term plan for growth, because that is the only way this country is going to grow.
Sarah Jones, Minister of State for Business and Trade, Energy and Net Zero. Thank you very much for joining us. Well, we also have with us here Scarlett Maguire, Director at the polling company JL Partners, who is looking at the polls, looking at opinion. This shift in tone then from the pain to what the gain might be down the line, is that the kind of messaging that's going to get some of these voters who just a few weeks ago voted for Labour but already in some instance saying that they're not sure, get them back on board?
I think it's definitely the sort of messaging they should have led with from the start. I think especially if you think about policy announcements, particularly thinking of the winter fuel cut, when the cut to winter fuel payments, I think they needed to embed that in a wider narrative and appreciate what the minister was just saying about, not sure about telling a story. Well, I think there's an awful lot to be said for telling a story, because otherwise it can be quite difficult for the public to know what's going on and to fit it into a wider framework. And I think part of what you're seeing with Labour is actually a lesson that I think Rishi Sunak learned. So he came to power with more baggage and I think with more party problems to sort out and with less, I think, a sort of rope given to him by the public, less benefit of the doubt. But I think he learned the same thing, which actually I think he thought it was enough to be a contrast to some of the chaos that had come before him and to get on with technocratically managing and to say, you will see benefit eventually, but for the time being, I need to get on and govern and I need to do things. I think that's a little bit what we're seeing from Labour now. And actually, the problem is that we've seen with Rishi Sunak, that's not quite enough, because it creates a void, it creates a vacuum, and into that you allow more negative things to spill in. So some of the things we've been seeing about some of the sleaze allegations, but also then some of the more negative things like the sort of policy announcements that we saw. When we did a poll of Labour voters in early August, the thing they'd most noticed about a Labour government, the policy they most noticed was the cut to winter fuel payments, above and beyond anything else. So when you're having the only things that are cutting through being negative things, it's no wonder then people are starting to get a bit turned off.
You talked about Rishi Sunak. Obviously, he had those more than a decade of other Conservative governments and coalition governments behind him. And this is a matter of weeks, isn't it? And they do seem genuinely shocked by the negative polling and the reaction, don't they? I mean, what does that tell you?
Well, I mean, I think on the one level, it is quite shocking. You know, on paper, you wouldn't expect to get a majority on the same scale of Blair's. And then within 2 months, I mean, imagine if Blair within 2 months was less popular than William Hague, for example. I mean, you can't really imagine it. And actually, you know, I think, and then Rishi Sunak's sort of even more extreme example of that, given where he was when he left office. But on the other hand, I don't think you necessarily should be surprised. I mean, we were picking up on this throughout the campaign. It wasn't that Labour were driven to power on this great wave of enthusiasm. In fact, the public were feeling incredibly pessimistic about politicians, incredibly sceptical. There was this huge mood of anti-politics. That is still pervasive. It was going to take Labour to do a lot to prove they weren't just the same as everyone else. And unfortunately, again, in the absence of any positive story, and then added to that, these stories of them being just the same as all the politicians in the sleaze, in the clothes of nations and all the rest of it. That's just adding to the sense that the public just getting sick of it, and they are going to keep turning towards other parties.
And is that the biggest danger, is that the public do think they are the same, not just, you know, when it comes to sleaze these kind of allegations, but in terms of the big economic policy, because you've got Rachel Reeves saying this is not going to be austerity.
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right to link those two things together. And if I was Labour right now, that's what I'd be most worried about. When we polled Labour voters, we found that half of them would consider voting for the Green Party. A quarter would vote reform, would vote reform. And I think this is what they've got to deal with. Yes, people might not be turning back en masse to the Tories, but in some ways, the Keir Starmer government could have been the sort of last gasp of centrism in this country. Because, yes, we don't have the same electoral system as our European counterparts, but the mood is there, and it's fractured, and it could fracture increasingly as people turn towards populist options on their left and their right.
Scarlett, many thanks. Scarlett Maguire, director at the polling company JL Partners there. Now, last Saturday, the big fight at Wembley. It started that night with the Liam Gallagher concert. It ended like this. Daniel Dubois denying Anthony Joshua the chance of becoming a three-time world heavyweight champion. Their fifth round knockout there. 96,000 people watching that Battle of the Britons. But Oliver Brown, the Telegraph's chief sports writer, he was not one of them, even though he wanted to be. And he's on the line now to tell us why. Well, why, Oliver?
Yes. Been in some fairly outrageous situations in my time, but this kind of took things to a new level. I mean, a path to this fight for me to cover was all agreed by multiple people until I wrote a piece last Friday that criticised the Saudi bankrolling of the occasion. I used such phrases as London was being turned into Saudi Disneyland, and to say that the PR executives working on behalf of the Saudis were angry would be an understatement. And 3 hours later, I got a message saying, we presume that you no longer want to cover this because you clearly disapprove of Saudi involvement in boxing. To which I responded, no, I very much do want to come. But by the time I arrived at Wembley on fight night, various flustered people arrived in the lobby to tell me that I wouldn't be welcome and that there was nothing they could do. And various calls by me and by my editor went unanswered until I had no option but to leave and eventually write a piece calling the situation out.
What's the reaction been to the piece?
It's been very heartening, actually. There's been, huge support across the industry that banning a British writer from covering a British fight at a British stadium because of an opinion about Saudi Arabia is just unconscionable. And the Football Association have tonight, in a piece we're running, said that they will act. David Bernstein, the former chief executive of the FA, calling it a flagrant breach of freedom of speech. So that's all very encouraging.
This took place in Wembley, but this was nothing to do with Wembley itself, just to be clear.
No, this was officially billed as Riyadh Season Wembley Edition, which I thought from the outset was problematic. I mean, you're probably familiar with how the Saudis are annexing boxing almost totally now. And, you know, that branding just suggests that Britain and London is effectively just a subsidiary of the Saudi state now, as far as boxing is concerned.
Well, look, Oliver, many thanks for coming on and telling us about your experience. That's Oliver Brown, the Telegraph's chief sports writer there. We're going to return to the Middle East now. It's not featuring prominently on the main stage at the Labour Party conference here in Liverpool. However, tensions over the government's policy towards Israel did surface in the main hall today. A heckler who was loudly making a point about continuing British arms sales to Israel was dragged out of the Chancellor's speech.
Their dishonesty and their rule breaking.
Well, he's shouting no arms sales to Israel there. It's a sentiment that represents a wing of the party that wants the government to go further in suspending arms export licences to Israel. Earlier this month, you may remember, the Foreign Secretary David Lammy announced that the UK was stopping the sale of 30 pieces of equipment after a review found that there was a clear risk they could be used to commit serious violations of international law. Israel, for one, was highly critical of that decision. Well, I've been getting a feel of the Middle East debate here at the Labour Party conference, beginning after he was removed from the conference, just outside its perimeter, with that heckler.
Labour wants to brand themselves as the party of change, and I think it's really important to have a counter-narrative to that. We're still selling arms to Israel whilst there's a genocide going on. I think it's really important that the UK recognise its role internationally in validating Israel's actions, and I think if we are able to internationally take a stand against that, it will put a lot of pressure on the government to stop what they're doing.
So Rachel Reeves, of course, after you were taken out, made the point we are not a party of protest anymore. What do you say to that?
I say to that protest is a very important part of the democratic process. I like to think that framing the conference in a way where we're not going to necessarily accept what the Labour government wants to call change is what we're happy to call change.
When that protester interrupted her speech, Rachel Reeves used it to make the point that Labour, she said, is no longer a party of protest. But get outside the main hall, go to some of the fringe events here at the conference, and you can hear that there are plenty of people in the party who do share that view.
Labour's on the arms trade suspended some licences. It's done so because it is forced to acknowledge those weapons may be used to violate international law. Well, if you accept that argument, then how can you sell any weapons?
Among the MPs speaking at these pro-Palestinian events, Bel Ribeiro Addy, who's MP for Clapham and Brixton Hill.
Tens of thousands of Palestinians, children, killed. And the only way we're going to actually stop this happening is if we show from where we are in the UK that we do not support this, so we will not sell arms that are complicit. I don't want us to be complicit. People are extremely uncomfortable that British weapons are being used to kill Palestinians.
And you know what David Lammy said. He said this is a legal decision that's been taken. Do you accept that?
We are lawmakers, and laws are made to be changed if they don't suit the current situation. If there's a will, there's a way.
She was taken hostage by Hamas militants. As she was taken across the fields, there were hundreds of civilians running towards the kibbutz, and they were running with sticks and with knives, and they were shouting, "Itbach el Yahud," which means kill the Jews.
Families of the hostages still being held in Gaza by Hamas tell their stories to an audience which includes some current members of parliament and at least one former Labour MP, Luciana Berger. In fact, she left the party over the accusations of anti-Semitism under Jeremy Corbyn's leadership, but she's now back in the fold.
You know, just hearing the testimonies of the families, what they've had to endure over the course of the past 12 months is unfathomable. There are 101 innocent people of five different faiths still being held captive by Hamas, a terrorist organisation in Gaza. And I think sometimes we forget about those hostages, or certainly when we hear some of the statements from not just our own government but others, it's easy to forget.
What should the government then be doing to rectify that situation?
First and foremost, making sure sure that the hostages are never forgotten. Hamas could release them and should release them, and that should be an absolute priority.
And a question that was asked, I don't think it was answered, was about what the government has done in terms of arms sales to Israel and what impact that is having. What's your view on that?
As someone who is a former Member of Parliament, sat on the Arms Export License Committee, I know that, you know, we do have a very prescriptive regime in this country.
That was a purely legal choice, not a political one in any way, you think?
No, I certainly believe that was a legal choice, but I also think it's incumbent on governments to be doing things to compensate for those decisions if it can be interpreted as a government basically not doing everything that it can do. And I think today really focuses minds about how much more still needs to be done.
Luciana Berger there, former Labour Member of Parliament, speaking to me at one of the fringe events here at the Labour Party conference. Our closing headline tonight, officials in Lebanon say almost 500 people have been killed and more than 1,600 injured after a wave of Israeli airstrikes in the south of the country. The Lebanese Health Minister Firaz Abiad told us that thousands of people were fleeing their homes and heading north to escape the bombardment. Israel says it has struck around 1,300 Hezbollah targets since this morning. That is The World Tonight. This is James Kamara-Sami. I'll be back tomorrow at 10. But for now, from me and everyone on the programme, have a very good night.
I'm Katya Adler from the Global Story podcast. Today, we're looking at Sudan and the brutal conflict raging there. We hear from some of the millions of civilians brutalised and displaced. It's been dubbed the Forgotten War. But is it more ignored than forgotten by the international community? And if so, why? Find us wherever you get your podcasts.